Admiral James Stavridis is the dean of the Fletcher School at Tufts University and former Supreme Allied Commander at NATO from 09 to 2013, and is author of his brand new book, Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans. And he also has a book out, The Leader's Bookshelf. Admiral, welcome back.
Great to be with you, Brian.
Admiral, first off, we always hear about problems with North Korea, but for the first time in a generation, first time for this president, he will have within his term a foe that could reach the west coast of the United States, possibly with a nuclear missile. So he cannot afford to have strategic patience, correct?
Absolutely right. And the way to think of this is sort of two streams that are coming together, Brian. One is the nuclear weapons themselves and miniaturizing them. And the second stream is the ballistic missiles, the range of which are increasing. When those two streams cross, it's like in Ghostbusters, you really don't want them to cross. That is when Kim Jong-un, an unstable and unpredictable leader, will have the capability to hit targets in the western United States. That's coming in the next year or so, and therefore the situation demands a response. And Lieutenant General McMaster, who you just had on a moment ago, is correct in his assessment.
He is. And of course, that's what President Obama said to President-elect Trump. He said the country that you got to deal with right away, the number one country, was North Korea. And it caught this president by surprise. But I love the people around him. You know, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff is Dunford. You have McMaster, a great general in his own right, I think a three-star. And then you have General Kelly here on Homeland, so he knows the danger here at home. And General Mattis is Secretary of Defense. And anyone who's like you, who has seen war, will go to great lengths to avoid war. So,
exactly.
Also, but also understands the need sometimes that you have to go to war. So, what options, without giving away the store, do we have? Did you see anything promising when it comes to North Korea?
I think we have some options, but they're not a terrific set. Option one is what President Trump and President Xi explored down at Mar-a-Lago, which is a combined U.S.-China diplomatic and sanctions package, because only the Chinese, with the control they have over the Korean economy, can really make sanctions bite. So that's one option. A second option is, let's call it covert activities, special forces, cyber attacks. That would have some capability. Or a third option, which would be the most dramatic, Brian, would be using that carrier group, using long-range bombers, and going overtly after the nuclear program, which is deeply buried and very hardened and would be a very difficult set of targets. So of those three, I'm going to start with option one and hope that we can get the Chinese on board. We ought to be preparing options two and three, and I know that we are.
I think we are. And when President Trump says, you know, I'm going to, if we're not going to get any help, I'm prepared to act on my own. The question is,
yep.
There's always a reason not to. Well, you know, they're developing. They don't have them. Once they have them, that enables, you could say, enables or leaves a president with no option. When the option is, well, continue to talk, they'll say, what's the prudent thing to do? Risk all of Seoul or talk and see if we can put pressure? But now that little by little, I think people are seeing the options are narrowing rapidly.
Exactly right. And again, when those two streams cross, and they will over the next 18 to 24 months, we will lose optionality. Therefore, now is the time to make the big press. And that's why this administration, I think correctly, is hoping that the signal of striking Syria will actually have a, shall we say, a clarifying effect on the mind of Kim Jong-un, demonstrating that if pushed, we are willing to use force.
Evidently, he's in hiding. Is that would you be surprised at that?
I would not. If I were him, I would make myself as scarce as possible, because a part of that covert option two that I mentioned, Brian, might include what sometimes is called decapitation, which is going after the leader in the hope that whatever comes next is a better opportunity for negotiation. So he's got to be aware of that. That special forces option is out there, and I think he will not be making a lot of high visibility previously announced appearances for the immediate future.
So, you know, he was asked, was McMahon, you know, what? Why am I doing this? Isn't that the prudest thing to do, sending an aircraft, turning an aircraft carrier around? North Korea is in a pattern of provocative behavior. So we'll see where this goes, and we'll see what type of support he has. Now, just shifting gears over to Syria now, what do you think that the 59 Tomahawks did, and what didn't it do?
I think the thing it did was create a strategic signal that the United States is willing to use force, that President Trump said the chemical acts crossed lines for him, and therefore he responded to a line that he had felt and set. That's a very good thing. What it did not do is really change the facts on the ground. 59 Tomahawks is a significant strike, but it's not going to take out the Syrian Air Force, nor is it going to significantly degrade their overall capability. So low tactical effect, high strategic effect is how I would call that one.
Excuse me if I got the name of the ships wrong, but I could tell you the style. I think the Russians sent a destroyer our direction in the Persian Gulf to, I guess, to greet the George H.W. Bush that was there and others. That was the reaction to the Tomahawk strike. What does that send? What kind of message is that?
Well, this is the Russians attempting to show that they're extremely displeased with our action, that they feel that our strikes have no validity in international law. They're wrong on that count, by the way, and they are demonstrating that they have capability themselves. What they are doing specifically, Brian, is playing to their own domestic audience in Russia. The Russian people have been fed nothing but a diet of, look how terrific your Russian military is in Syria, and all of a sudden they get a bit of a bloody nose. So they're going to show globally that they have reach and stretch, and they can come up alongside U.S., in this case, Navy assets. We'll see more of that back and forth. It all has a very Cold War feel to it.
So I will say this morning we get up to this missive from Russia and Iran. They say the aggression against Syrians oversteps all red lines. We will react firmly to any aggression against Syria and to any infringement of red lines, whoever carries them out. The United States knows very well our ability to react. That's a statement from a website from Russia, which also includes Iran and Hezbollah. How would you digest that?
I think it is a direct threat against U.S. forces operating in Syria. So this Tehran-Moscow axis has been building over the last couple of years, and they are in highly, highly collusive behavior against the Syrian moderate opposition that we're supporting. We have special forces in Syria. We're constantly flying strikes against the Islamic State over Syria. They're threatening us, and we should not react. We should not overreact to it, Brian. On the other hand, we need to increase the readiness of our forces in the region, and I'm quite sure General Mattis is doing so.
Possibly. Here's Lieutenant General H.R. McMaster on what happens if Russia defends its interests. Cut four.
We would want to appeal rationally to Russia. This is a great opportunity for the Russian leadership to reevaluate what they're doing, why they are supporting a regime that is committing mass murder against its own people. And so Russia could be part of the solution. Right now, I think everyone in the world sees Russia as part of the problem.
Not everyone, but a lot. And NATO's meeting, you know, they're having the G7, and then NATO Supreme Commander's coming to Washington, I believe, on Thursday or later on this week. So
yes.
Do you see this as an opportunity? The Russia is a belligerent but rational actor usually.
Yes, I think there's a possibility of improvement in Russian behavior, but I'd call it a very low possibility. And this, of course, is what Secretary Tillerson will be discussing with his counterpart, Foreign Minister Lavrov, in Moscow. We will open up channels of communication, and I think H.R. McMaster is right to say Russia could be part of the solution. Unfortunately, I just think the odds of that are very low.
Me too. But it's nice to hear. How do you think it's going to go, being that they haven't called, Lavrov has not called off the Secretary of State? They're still coming on Tuesday. And this is even though he's an experienced man at 70, he has never really been a diplomat before. So, and he doesn't really have an undersecretary right now or a deputy. So how do you think this is going to go?
Well, I'm concerned, as you and I have spoken about, with the fact that thus far Secretary Tillerson has no support. Not only does he not have an undersecretary, deputy secretary, he has no assistant secretaries, et cetera. The entire upper level of the bureaucracy is without is missing information. So that's one problem, is just getting him staffed up and prepared for these extremely complex meetings. Secondly, he has never played at this level in terms of international interest, the ability to try and reduce a conflictual situation, very, very demanding, to put him in it with no backup at all. And then thirdly, Lavrov, on the other hand, the diplomat across the table, is deeply experienced. He's been at this game for decades. He speaks perfect English. He's a very sophisticated player. So Secretary Tillerson's going to have his hands full, but he's a smart man. He's a common sense guy. He's a kind of a tough, steady Texan. I think he'll do okay. But it'll be a challenging set of meetings for him.
In 4 minutes, we'll take calls at 1-866-408-7669. But before I let you go, Admiral, you got the sense that even though President Trump has talked before in the past on we can't spend trillions of dollars on another Middle Eastern country, he took action. Now with Russia, he wants to try a reset. But when he saw the way they were acting, he took action, jeopardized that relationship. And now when it comes to NATO, he talked tough with them. Do you feel as though eventually he'll come around to the more of a need for NATO? And has he already gotten a lot by giving him a brushback pitch early on as a candidate and an early launch?
Yeah, it's a good way to put it. I think the brushback has, in fact, increased some levels of defense spending in Europe, which is necessary and good. I think, as I hear the tone coming out of the administration, they are becoming greater fans of NATO. And let's face it, everything you and I have been talking about will require coalitions, allies, and partners, because we don't want to be the world's policeman and do this by ourselves. But we can be the leader of coalitions that have real impact in places like Syria and North Korea and elsewhere. So I think NATO can play well in that role. Let's hope that the dialogue coming up over the next couple of weeks continues to reinforce that.
All right. The author of the book is the author of the book I'm just speaking to now. The name of the book is Sea Power, The History and Geopolitics of the World's Oceans and the Leader's Bookshelf. Those are both gettable?
Yeah, I think absolutely.
And you can get that, the best way to get that, or you could also tweet you at Stavridis, Stavridisj, correct?
Yeah, and they're both on Amazon. You can snap them up now.
All right, we'll just do a segment on that right now, but we're going to need another chapter when it comes to sea power as we have that aircraft carrier steaming into the Korean Peninsula. Thanks so much.